Welcome to Unparented, where the untold stories of the foster care system come to light. I'm your host, Mona Renee, with over two decades of experience in child welfare. I've seen the inner workings, the successes, but more often the hidden struggles of a system that may do more harm than good. Each week, we'll dive deep into the raw and uncensored stories from our personal experiences, as well as candid conversations from former foster care children and fellow workers. These are the voices that are rarely heard, the stories that need to be told. Join me as we unveil the status quo, complexities, and challenges as we advocate for a brighter future. It's time to lift the veil on the foster care system. This is Unparented. Hello. Oh, we have a different guest today. We have someone that has called in from outside of the state of Michigan. So this is going to be a different conversation just by you being on the phone. So I appreciate you giving us a call and wanting to be on the podcast today. And this particular person is someone that I've known, probably met you when you were about 15, maybe 13 years old. So if you would like to tell our audience a little bit about yourself, we can go ahead and get started.
Yes. Hi, Mona. Hi. My name is Desiree Hardiman. Okay. And that is accurate. We have known each other for a very long time.
Okay.
I believe we met when I was 14.
Okay.
14 years old, and I am 32 going on 33.
Wow. So
yeah. And it's been a wonderful knowing you. It's been a long time, but hey, I'm looking forward to a many more years of this relationship that began so long ago.
All right. That sounds good. You know, it has been quite the pleasure in seeing you grow and mature and developing into the wonderful young lady that I knew was inside when I met you.
You know, I want to expound on that a little bit more because, you know, Mona, you weren't just a social worker to me. You were like a mother fighting. You just fought for me. And you never stopped loving and caring about me, ever. You fought for your babies. We were Mona's babies. And Mona, every single one of us, I can only speak for myself, but just from knowing you personally, I know this is how you are, just with every child, wanting to make sure that we were home. Really, that was your goal, was to get us in a back home with our family members, even if it wasn't mom or dad. You wanted us to have somebody that we knew that was family. And so I appreciate you through the years sending me birthday cards and checking on me, asking about my family that God bless me to eventually get back to. You were part of the reason why I was able to really make it through my situation. So I want to thank you
for that. Oh, that just warmed my heart right there. Help. That just warmed my heart. Okay. All right. Well, if you could take us down your life journey through the system as far back as you can remember, if you want to start there. And I know you are a direct witness to a parent with mental health issues. So if you could kind of
give us going back down memory lane. You know, I remember being a part of the system. I believe it began when I was four. You know, my mother was a young mother. She had both me and my sister in her teenage years.
Okay.
And so, you know, that is difficult growing up where you are a child mm-hmm. and, you know, having a child.
Right.
And so, you know, my mom, very brilliant young woman. Mm-hmm. And it was not going to be doable for her to care for us alone because she was so young. So, mm-hmm. of course, I thank God for my grandmother. I thank God for, you know, my pastors and those who I really grew up around. They really stepped in, aunts and uncles, they stepped in to really help her to care for us while she was going to school and working full time and still trying to grow up herself.
Okay.
You know, and so I remember at the age of 4, being diagnosed with ADHD. I remember having to be put on like pills, like Wellbutrin. There was another pill that I couldn't remember, but I remember having to take pills at such a very young age and being told that, oh yeah, you know, the reason why your child's not able to sit still is because she has attention deficit hyperactive disorder and a couple other things that I don't even remember that they were saying about me at such a very young age growing up, not even having to really understood what that meant, just being me. To me, I'm just being a child, but to them, you know, I had a problem.
Okay.
And so from there, me and my sister growing up under that, having caseworkers come into the home, making sure that our home environment was safe for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one particular time and where I was a little bit older than 4. And, you know, the first encounter I had with my mother, well, as far as I can remember, having a mental breakdown was when just before the caseworker was coming to check in on us, ask us questions, make sure that things were clean and, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, I remember her telling us, both me and my sister, that she was having a mental breakdown. And I remember her laying across the couch with her head or her hand on her head. I didn't know what that meant, you know, being a child, but I knew that something was wrong. And right. so because we had, you know, my mom has had those issues for quite some time. I felt at times as a child, me and my sister both, hey, we can take care of our mom. Though that was not our responsibility at all. That's just something that we had gotten used to. And I said, don't worry, mommy. I said, I'll clean up. I'll clean up the house. Now, I didn't really know how to clean well. I knew how to make things neat, and I knew how to hide a bunch of stuff.
Okay, okay.
To make it look like it, make an appearance that it was clean.
Okay.
So I knew what the requirements were because we had, you know, we had been a part of the system for so long and had caseworkers. We knew their level of expectation. So I tried to meet it as best as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when the caseworker came over and she was asking us questions. And of course, as a child, I knew that there were some things that I didn't want to say, but there were other things that I just blurted out without thinking, which was fine. But until I found out that that could really get us taken away from our mom.
Okay.
So when she came over, I told her, I said, yeah, I was excited because I helped mommy out. I said, yeah, I cleaned up everything. And then she started writing stuff down. And she said, well, why did you do that? And she didn't seem very happy and pleased. So when she said, well, why did, you know, when her facial expressions were showing her displeasure of the fact that I was cleaning up everything. And I immediately became frightened because she was not pleased or happy with me doing that.
Okay.
And I said, well, because mommy was having a mental breakdown. So that's all I saw her do was write.
Okay.
But yeah, so that was the first situation where I really remember my mom having a mental breakdown, not knowing what was happening in her mind, but knowing that it took her to a place where she just could not do anything. She just laid on the couch inactive, not able to even be a mother at certain points. Yeah.
Now, do you remember any workers for your mom, anyone coming into the home for your mom, or your mom going to, you know, see a counselor or going to places to talk to people herself?
I don't remember that, although I do remember my mom mentioning later on in my life that she did.
Okay.
That, you know, she was in therapy and she was a member, and actually still is a member of a clubhouse that helps people with those types of issues.
Okay. Okay. And now you had mentioned staying with your grandparents. So do you know if there was anything official? Would you stay for long periods, or, you know, was this just weekends or just a few days at a time? Or did you stay with them, you know, for longer periods of time?
Yes. So I actually, me and my sister, both and my mom, we stayed with my grandparents in their house that they had at one point back in Michigan. And at that time, her brother and sister, they were still teenagers. They were not able to go out and live on their own. So they were living at home with my grandparents. Okay. And because I don't remember the reason why, but I'm assuming it's because we didn't have a place to live of our own.
Okay.
And so we ended up moving in with them. And then on top of that, my grandparents had her twin sister living there along with her two kids, because her twin sister, my aunt, was going through abuse from her husband.
Okay. Okay. So that's a lot of people in one house.
There's a lot of people in one house. You really don't think to keep track because everybody is blood related.
Mm-hmm.
However, nobody knew that me and my sister were being molested by my uncle.
Okay. The teenage uncle in the house.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he had been doing that for quite a while. I learned from my sister, she remembers, you know, the age of two.
Okay.
Him doing these things at the age of two. And mind you, he was also a child. He was an older child, but he was a child when he began doing things like this. And not trying to give him an excuse, but just to kind of give you an idea of, you know, his age group and when that began. Because I remember living with my grandparents when I was a little bit older, around 6 and 7.
Mm-hmm.
And so during that time we were living there, he was probably around 14, 15, between 14 and 16 years old.
Okay.
At that particular time.
Okay.
I'm so sorry.
Did you all share a room with him, or do you remember the sleeping arrangements and how all that went, or was he in charge of babysitting you guys?
No, he was not in charge of babysitting us. He was actually just Uncle Jermaine,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he would come up and carry me to his room.
Because
I wasn't sleeping in, you know, we were girls. And so he had the boys share the room and then the girls shared a room.
Okay.
And so he would come and he would carry me. I remember just one particular time where he carried me up the steps and into his room, and that's when he would molest me.
Oh, wow.
And at one point, the first time he had ever tried, it got so bad to where it wasn't just molestation anymore. He almost raped me.
Oh,
but
my.
He did not succeed.
Okay.
He did not, and I praise God for that. He did not succeed. And my aunt, she came into the room. She called out his name. I remember the quote, what type of clothes I was wearing. I remember wearing a white shirt and a little black skirt.
Oh, my.
And I remember her calling out his name. And he said, yeah. And she asked a question from afar. So then he was direct. He was like, hurry up. He said, no, leave your clothes off. You go over there. And I said, no. And I panicked. Mm-hmm. Even then. But it would seem as if also there was relief there because somebody stopped him.
Okay.
And I didn't know what he was doing because I'm still a child, so mm-hmm. I don't know what is happening in all honesty.
Okay.
All I know is that he was, as a grown woman, he was getting ready to rape me.
Okay. And so you were able to tell your story after your sister told what was going on first?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. That was something that I was very much afraid to do because being groomed as a child when you're molested, it's like fear is being put into you to never tell what is happening to you.
Right. Okay, so you and your sister were able to tell this story while you're living with your grandparents. So what happened after that? What happened to the uncle? What happened to your
mom? Yeah, so just before we were taken, Deanna was very terrified because our uncle had ran away from home.
Okay.
And he came running to my mother. And of course, we're living with our mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's seeking to live with my mother for a little while.
Oh.
Yeah. And of course, at that time, my mom did not know anything. And I remember when my mom told us that he was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what to do. All I knew is I could not tell anybody what had happened to us, what had been happening to us. But I remember Deanna running so fast. Mm. It's like she ran like a lightning bolt to my mother's room, and she hid terrified.
Oh, wow.
And she's older than me by a couple of years, but I remember her doing that and later telling me as we got older that he had slammed her on the sidewalk outside. And at that point, I believe that's when she just had enough. I believe she didn't know that the same thing was happening to me because we didn't really tell each other until a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about it. And she said the same thing happened to her. So I think at that point, that's when she had enough because she was always very protective of me. Always. I was her baby.
Okay.
even though we were only almost 2 years younger, I was her baby. And so I think that was her breaking point where, okay, I've got to protect me and her.
Okay.
Even if that means us being removed from the home.
Okay.
So during that time, that was where the police came knocking late at night, and Jermaine was there.
Okay.
And he didn't do anything to me, though. He did not. He didn't touch me. He didn't do anything to me at all, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he did anything to Deanna, but I know for a fact that he did not. He didn't even dream of it because I believe he was afraid that he would get caught by my mother.
Okay.
But that very night, there was police that came. And they knocked on the door, and my mother was like, oh, hold on just a minute. And they were about ready to break down the door. Didn't matter if you didn't have any clothes on. They said, ma'am, if we knock on the door and we tell you to answer, you answer. We don't care if you don't have any clothes on or not. That's how serious the situation was for them.
Okay.
And And so when they came, my mother got us dressed. The caseworker showed up with them, mm-hmm. and they escorted us in the police car and told us we were going to St. John's home.
Okay. Okay. And now you think that was because of what the uncle had done, and he was there at the house and wasn't supposed to be there? Is that what you're thinking?
I believe that was part of it, but I believe it was also because of the issues that my mother had.
Okay.
And she was just not able to take care of us. There was two instances where we had gotten taken away. And the first time, she had an opportunity to get herself together, mm-hmm. go to therapy, make sure she had a good job, and she could get me and Deanna back.
Okay.
Then that last time that I just spoke about, that was it. Her rights were completely terminated.
Okay.
Because she was not able to take responsibility for us and make sure that we were safe, mm-hmm. Because she herself was not able to be a mother on top of her issues of where she said she had schizophrenia. So I can't remember what the diagnosis was.
And
so it just got to the point where she had to give us up.
Okay. Okay. All right. So now you and your sister are in care. Can you remember any placements that you had initially? Were they with your sister, or you were in two different places? Okay.
Yeah, so it was nice because at first they had us together.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it so much easier. And for me, Deanna was like mom to me anyway, because she just treated me as her baby, as I stated earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So having her with me really was important.
Okay.
Because even though I knew I was not home with mom anymore,
mm-hmm.
I still felt safe, and I believed that I could make it as long as my sister was there with me.
All right. Okay. Boy, that says a lot.
Yeah, it is, because, you know, when we got into the St. John's home,
mm-hmm.
Deanna had already had some issues, anger issues, and as we got older, I began to understand why, you know, and what her emotional struggles were, as well as really coming to realize what mine were, and that I had some too.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't until we separated. But when we went into the St. John's home together, it was fun for me.
Okay.
And I got to know a lot of different people. I had a lot of moms. For me, it was, I was like that since I was a kid. I could get to know people,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, connect with people very quickly, whereas Deanna had a little bit of difficulties with that. Okay. Then we ended up in a foster care home together.
Okay.
And I remember that first night we had fried chicken, and I love fried chicken. I was eating.
Okay.
But Deanna, oh, yeah, I tore that chicken up, and I had no problem talking and connecting.
Mm-hmm.
But Deanna, on the other hand, she did. She was just hurting, and I really could not relate to her at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I remember her refusing to eat.
Oh.
She just couldn't eat. And I said, honey, eat your food before it gets cold, and she knew I couldn't understand, so she didn't really talk to me much about, you know, the pain inside.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know, could you remember how long you guys stayed there in that particular home together?
Yeah, I don't believe it was very long. It might have been 4 or 6 months or less. It wasn't very long that we were in that home together.
Okay. Okay. And then for the next home, do you remember, were you guys still together?
We actually ended up going back to the St. John's home. And I believe it may have been because Deanna didn't like the lady.
Okay.
She told me that. I remember, you know, it's funny when you're talking about stuff, our memories just pop back up. I remember her saying, I don't like her.
Oh,
and I was like, yeah. I said, yeah, but she feeds us good. We get to eat fried chicken. She gave us, she bought us ice cream. Mm-hmm. And she just expressed greatly she didn't like it. And I don't remember who our caseworker was at that time, but I know that they want the child to feel comfortable. You know, right, it's important right. for us children to feel comfortable in the homes that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was something that I do remember. If we did have an issue, we could talk to our caseworker, and I appreciated that for sure.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I think that's why we were out of there so quickly and back in the St. John's home.
Okay. Okay. But you don't remember anything, any actions that may have been taken by the foster parent, at her being abusive or not being nice or anything like that?
No, I don't remember because I was younger. And I think, Deanna was a teenager. I was in my adolescent years.
Okay.
So, you know, I think teenagers experience, you know, at that age, mm-hmm. something a little bit different because she really did have an attitude of her own.
Okay. Okay.
You know, and I believe that she was not afraid to challenge anybody. Okay. So I think it may have been because she was older. That in her teenage years that she may have been a little bit more of a challenge
okay.
than I was.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, the on to the next placement. Were you, after St. John's, did you both go to another foster home together, or was that one try? Tell me about that.
You know, when we went back to St. John's, I believe that is when we ended up separating.
Okay.
And they like to keep siblings together.
Mm-hmm.
If one sibling is difficult, you know, they tend to want to put that particular child in a facility that is capable of handling the needs of that child.
Okay.
And Deanna was a very angry individual.
Okay.
And I remember her always getting restrained. Mm-hmm. And I remember going up to her when she was lying, being restrained on the floor, just acting a fool.
Mm-hmm.
And because she would just get upset and out of control. And so she would, when they would try and calm her down, they would come and get me.
Oh.
Say, hey, can you try to come and calm your sister down? And I would see her on the floor. I'm like, yeah, quit acting like that. And she would be lying there. Sometimes she would smile. Mm-hmm. And she's like, no, because they may be mad. And I said, yeah, but I said, y'all, you're in trouble. You're not going to be able to go anyplace.
Okay.
And so after a while, it got so bad where she just was constantly in the timeout room, getting restrained. And St. John's home was a very nice home. It was a place where you could really walk out the front door without, mm-hmm. you know, having to have a key.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you got to go places. And I remember when they told me, they warned me. They said, hey, if she keeps acting like this, you know, we're going to have to send her to a more secure facility.
Okay.
And I said, Deanna, I tried to encourage her. I said, don't act up. I said, you know, just talk about your feelings. And, you know, because that sounded like someone who's been in therapy, you know.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Hey, so right. Talk about your feelings. And so that's what I was trying to get her to do, but she just had such a hard time.
Okay.
And so I remember laying down, Mona, I laid down for a nap.
Mm-hmm.
And when I woke up, my sister was not there.
Oh, my.
And that mm-hmm. broke me. I had no problem. You know, it was very difficult. I cried for my mom. I cried. I came up with songs.
Mm.
You know, one particular song I remember singing was Mommy, I Miss You, Mommy.
Okay.
You know, I remember singing and I knew she couldn't hear me, but mm-hmm. my heart longed for her, but it just felt like everything was all right because Deanna, my sister, right. she was there.
Right.
And then when I woke up and she wasn't gone and I did not even get to say goodbye. They didn't even let me. So they didn't say, hey, Des, your sister's leaving. They didn't even do that. She was gone. And from there on, I found out how I really felt.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Yep.
That's a lot. That's a lot. And it's always been just you and her. It's always been just you and your sister.
Yeah.
Always been just you and your sister. Yeah. And they
did. Through it all.
Yep. They didn't even give you an opportunity to say goodbye. See you later.
No, they didn't.
See you later. How about that?
Nothing. Not where she was going. You know, nothing.
Okay.
Just took her out of there.
Okay.
And I remember bawling, crying.
Right.
And just being broken and torn in pieces. For all of that, oh, yeah, it's all right. It's going to be okay. It just went away.
Right.
It went away. Right. I didn't feel like everything was going to be all right anymore.
Right.
I didn't feel like I was safe being there alone without her.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like I was going to be able to make it anymore.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Wow. And you were probably what? Maybe 12 or so?
Yeah, I was about 12 years old.
Okay.
When I, at that point, 12 to 13.
Okay.
When that was it.
Okay. So while you're in care, are you having any visits with your mom,
to the best of my memory, I do remember her coming to St. John visiting.
Okay.
I remember her bringing us boxes of stuff. Like, my mom was just so good at finding things for a really cheap price.
Okay.
She was good at that. And she would bring, even though we weren't really old enough, she would buy us wigs and stuff because I think, you know, my mom's mind, eventually they're going to become young women and maybe they want to start, you know, exploring with different hairstyles, and she wore wigs. So she just brought a variety of different things for us to have. And I appreciated it because, hey, you know, this came from my mom.
Right.
This is special.
Right.
My mom doing this.
Right. And were they doing a good job of taking care of your hair?
No. Because, okay. Okay. My hair was not, I mean, they tried, mm-hmm. and I think at one point they just ended up taking us to hair salons.
Okay.
And going to get our hair braided, especially for us young black girls. That was just not a task that they could really tackle.
Okay. Well, that's okay. But were they consistent with that?
You know, yeah, they were. They were pretty consistent with that. They would take us and set appointments every so often.
Okay.
And I do remember like having ponytails, you know, that's a quick, easy hairstyle.
Mm-hmm.
Throw them in little ponytails and say, okay, your hair's done.
Okay. 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 So during the course of you being in care, can you remember any workers at that time?
Yes. So I remember different ones. I have been to so many different places, but I actually still keep up with a lot of people.
Okay.
I remember, and this is just throughout the history, so it's not going to be necessarily in chronological order of when these people came into my life, but I remember Rashida. Oh my goodness. I remember this one particular guy. It's very rare that a guy could impact my life.
Oh.
But there was one, Tab Johnson.
Okay.
He worked at Wedgwood Christian.
Wedgwood and Christian then, Services.
Yes, thank you. Wedgwood Christian Services. And he was that. That was that for me. Okay. And, you know, I appreciated going to those places because these people, you know, they didn't just take care of me and, you know, help me through my struggles and my issues. They pointed me to Jesus.
Okay.
That was really what helped me through everything. Because, you know, Jesus is my life even today.
Okay.
I had somebody to hold on to, somebody everlasting to hold on to. And so that is the people that I'm getting ready to name. That's what they did.
Okay.
You know, they loved me. They cared for me, just like you
okay.
did.
Okay.
And
okay.
I had several other people just like you throughout my life. And it wasn't just where I had like five or six. It was just two or three, but that was really all that I needed.
Okay. So now with him, had you had any knowledge or any other connections that would have been like a father figure other than him?
I can't say so.
Okay.
You know, and do you want to know? I think the reason why is because I didn't have a dad growing up.
Okay.
I mean, I remember my grandfather here and there, but I don't have too much memory of him really just taking time to pour into me. And it may be because he was not my blood grandfather, but someone who did marry my grandmother when her kids were a little bit older, growing up into their adolescent years. So he had been with her for a while. But I don't have too much memory of him.
Okay.
But I think it's because there was such a long length of absence from my own father that I did not really consider a male model. I had mostly women who raised me.
Okay.
You know.
Well, how important could representation be in that situation? The need to have someone that you could identify as a father figure, to be respectful, appropriate, consistent. What I don't even know if he would realize that such a big part he played in not only your life, but in the lives of other children that look like you.
Yeah. You know, Mona, I had not thought about that. Because it's just been us ladies for so long. You know, having a father, it didn't really, not having a father, didn't impact me until I was an adult.
Right, right.
Because I realized I had missed out on something. You know? And so, it was a hole in my life. Because I believe that if I had a father, if I had a good father who really loved me, cared about me, told me about the importance of, you know, not looking for a relationship in just any man and having men running in and out of the house as my mom did. I don't know why or if, you know, she was just dating, but I had seen that.
Okay.
And that became normal for me. But if I had somebody who was in my life, like a father, to really teach me how a man should love a woman, how a man should treat his daughter, then I believe that would have made a whole difference in my life. And I would have had a little bit more structure. Okay. I would have had more stability. The family would have been complete. Okay. You know, okay. It would have been a complete.
Okay. Well, now, tell us a little bit about what you may know about your father, your biological father.
Yeah, so my father was a man who was already married.
Okay.
Yeah, and when I found that out, my mother told me, when I questioned her about it, she knew that she did not know, because that was something at that time I did not believe was right.
Okay.
I had a foundation of values and a biblical foundation. And so I felt the need to ask my mother if she knew.
Okay.
And she said no. And at that time, of course, we all know that my mother was a teenager. So I do believe that my father did take advantage of my mother when he was already in his late 30s.
Okay.
And my mother would tell me stories about him, though. She would say, when she would take him to visit me, that he would hold me. She would tell me how tall he was and how kind he was. And that he would tell me how much he loved me and cared about me, but I never really felt that because he was not there in the home to play with me, you know? And so I really, you know, didn't have or feel self-worth by men in general because of that absence of my father. And the fact that really, not because he didn't want to, but because of the things that he was doing, somebody murdered him.
Okay.
Yeah. He had just had a history. Me and my siblings coming together on my dad's side found out that, you know, he was just sleeping around with many different women, and his choices, you know, it caught up to him.
Okay.
And eventually somebody shot him dead.
Okay. That's a hard pill to swallow. And you have been handling a lot. You have been handling a lot. So when, about at what age did you find that out about your dad, that he had, he was deceased?
I found that out when I was 4 or 5. Okay. And, you know, it's crazy because I actually have a memory of going to his funeral. Very, very brief, but I remember me and my siblings sitting on the front row. We were all sitting together without our parents. I believe our parents were sitting behind us.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I remember having no emotion. No feeling. I didn't cry because I didn't know him.
Right. And you really didn't know what was going on, but.
No, okay. I didn't understand.
Okay.
I remember my mom telling me my father died.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there wasn't too many memories of him actually really being there, just, you know, being taken to him. Okay. But, you know, again, he wasn't there.
Okay. And then while you're in care, you didn't have any contact with his side of the family?
Yeah, I believe there was one particular time where I did.
Okay.
And that's where they found out that about my grandmother, my dad's mom.
Okay.
And she did not know that we were taking. I remember having a conversation with her later on. Mm-hmm. She didn't know what had happened, where we went. She couldn't get in touch with us. She said she looked for us. And the funny thing is, I was looking for her.
We
were at the library, and I remember when the Yellow Pages, I was very smart. I knew how to figure things out and how to look for people. And I knew her name, Mary Morgan. That was all I needed to know.
Okay.
And so when I typed her name in there, I would find so many different people who were named Mary Morgan. But I knew particularly that she lived in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So I narrowed my search down. And if I could get a hold of a phone, I would sneak and try and call and find her. Because I wanted her to come take me out of this situation. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So while you were in care and you're on your own now, were you placed in any foster homes by yourself?
Me and Deanna separated, and so I ended up having to go in to these strangers' homes all by myself.
Okay.
One particular one that I remember is when I lived in Lansing, Michigan.
Okay.
And I remember calling this woman Granny. You know, this woman was a 63-year-old woman taking care of a teenage girl, letting them into her home. Yeah.
Okay.
And she was a really, really good cook. I remember that, too. She had a catering service. Oh, yeah. And so we ate good all of the time. But when I first arrived there, you know, I had been in places where we were always given the option to go to church. And I appreciated that because I enjoyed going to church, learning about Jesus.
Okay.
And, God has always kept me, and he's always just had his watchful hand upon me. Because when I went into that home, she quickly said, hey, girls. I've decided that we're going back to church.
Okay.
So there had been a period of time where, you know, she wasn't going.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And suddenly, I don't know what happened, but she said, we're going back. And so I have been growing up in the church all of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was going to get adopted. And the funny, crazy part about this one is, I had left Whaley's Children's Center in Flint, and they had found me a foster care home. That's the one I'm thinking about now.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was 14 at that time. I was getting, you know, up there in age, and I had very good behavior.
Okay.
And so they wanted to put me in a place where I could potentially be adopted.
Okay.
And this particular woman, she had done that before. She adopted a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was an opportunity for me.
Okay.
To be adopted too. But I never did. I never got adopted.
Okay. Do you think that was your choice or her choice, or just you don't remember it coming up? Or
no, it did come up.
Okay.
It came up. Her granddaughter, and her name is Lily, she wanted to adopt me.
Oh.
She loved me so much.
Okay.
And she wanted to adopt me.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, though, she really didn't have a place of her own. She was actually living upstairs in her grandmother's house.
Okay.
But for whatever her reasons were, I just believe it's just because she just really loved me and wanted children of her own. And she really wasn't that much older than me, though. But that was a decision that she had made. And eventually, it got bad to the point where they were accusing me of stealing money, acting up, where I promised Mona when I went to that place, I had it in my mind and in my heart that I was going to behave because I wanted to stay.
Okay.
I wanted to stay. I had aunties. I had uncles. I had sisters. I had people who I thought really just loved me.
Okay. And before that, you hadn't really been anywhere that you felt like you wanted to stay.
Yeah, no, I haven't been anywhere I felt like that.
Okay.
Really, there was one particular person before I went to this foster care that wanted to adopt me too. Her name is Rashida. And she became a social worker just like you.
Oh, okay.
Eventually.
Okay.
But she was probably, if I was not going to, if I didn't have to leave and go to that foster home, I would have been adopted by her.
Okay. Okay.
But at that time, she had just got married. She even asked her husband. She asked her husband if she could adopt me. And he said no.
Oh, okay.
And she cried. And I remember before I had left, before I ended up leaving, she took me shopping. And this was just me and her.
Okay.
She took me to Dave and Buster's on her own dime. She bought me new clothes, anything that you could think of. She got it for me. She even wrote me a letter, which I tried to keep it, Mona. I tried to keep it in good condition. But eventually that letter got lost, and I read it every once in a while just so I could, you know, feel like she was there.
Okay.
She was like a mom. And she gave me her number and everything. And I actually still keep in contact with her today.
Okay.
But that was probably the only two people where I was like, yeah, this is where I feel safe, you know. This is where I want to be. This is home.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. And from this placement you talked about, you thought you were going to get adopted and you weren't. So from there, did that start your path to residential placements after that?
Yeah, eventually they just didn't put me in foster care anymore.
Okay.
You know, they had put me into different facilities. My behavior got really bad.
Okay.
I was acting up, showing out, showing off. It just, you know, to the point where I remember being in a juvenile detention center.
Okay.
You know, I felt like I went all over. I lived all over Michigan, but I quickly found out that wasn't true.
Well, you named quite a few places. You know, you got Grand Rapids, and then you said Lansing, and then I thought you said
Flint.
Yeah. So
Dearborn Heights.
Okay. Yeah, you did quite a few stops.
And the place where you brought me from, you brought me to eventually, because I remember you bringing me to a few different places trying to find somewhere where they just couldn't keep me.
Yeah.
I went to South Bend, Indiana, I believe, at one point. I don't remember the place, what the place was called, but it got so bad to where y'all had to take me out of the state of Michigan.
we sure did. Had to find a place. But it's quite unfortunate that we really weren't able to find out. You know, it's kind of like, you know, to say what happened, you know, what happened along the way, you know, what happened that made you think this way or feel this way. And, you know, I don't know, maybe at the time we just didn't know. And I know that I wasn't in a position to get to your therapeutic needs. So I really just had to address your housing needs, you know, find you a place, and hopefully in the place you would connect with a therapist there in order to help with any issues that you had. But I don't know if during your course of stay in residentials, if anyone ever really connected to find out why or how or, you know, what happened. Because you should not have been as disconnected for as long as you were. If someone were able to really try and address those issues, I don't know if that ever really happened.
Mona, no, it didn't. I don't believe I ever found anybody who I even myself believe that actually cared, besides a few staff members and yourself, you know. It's like when you're in therapy and somebody's just like, well, how did you feel about that? Mm-hmm. You know, just it seems like a script that they're going by rather than really, you know, hey, you know, what's going on in your life? How can I help you?
Right, right.
You know, what is it that you are feeling right now that you really haven't spoke about, wanting to speak about, but just haven't felt comfortable enough to speak about? You know, just really getting to that point where I could release the hurt. And I didn't realize until as I got older and older that I had suppressed it all in.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody could really understand it from my point of view.
Right.
Because you have all these people who, oh, yes, well, you know, how did you feel? You know, not really, to me, seeming to be able to relate to me in any kind of way for me to want to open up to them.
Right, right.
All I knew was I want to get out of this place.
Right.
And I know I need to talk to you. I got to talk to you, so I'm going to go tell you whatever.
Right.
You don't seem like you care. I believe I lied a couple times, Mona, when I was talking to these therapists. And they was like, you seem like you're really making progress. I said, yeah. And I really wasn't. I just knew at that point, to being in the system for so long, talking to so many therapists, I knew how to play them good because I'm like, you don't care. I'm not talking to you because you writing down stuff and I don't know what you're writing. I may not ever know, but I know how this works. And so you ain't going to get too much out of me. You writing some stuff down and you're not telling me what you're writing. That's suspicious to me. Mm. I can't tell you too much.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I believe that you have more to tell, and there is more that I would like for you to tell. So we will do a part two for you.
Okay. That sounds good.
Yeah, we will give you another call, and we will have two episodes to your story. And we will look forward to episode two with Desiree.
So, all right. Thank you so much for having me.
Yep. Thank you. All right. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Unparented. The stories we share here are not just tales of the past, but lessons and reminders for a better future. If this podcast resonates with you, please consider sharing it with someone who needs to hear these truths. Together, we can spread awareness and drive change. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And if you have a moment, please leave a review to help others find us. Lastly, join our community and follow us on Facebook. Your stories matter to us, and we'd love to hear from you. Whether you want to share your journey in person, call in, or send us your thoughts, please reach out to us at unparented41@gmail.com. Let's make a difference, one story at a time. Until next time, stay informed, and stay compassionate. This is Mona Renee, signing off.